Congressman Griffin, let's begin with the non-controversial Representative Ryan budget plan that has been at the top of the agenda for everybody these past couple of weeks. I'm obviously joking about it being non-controversial. Medicare has been one of the most controversial parts of this plan that comes out of here. Let me ask the question this way. Why do we not just get a Medicare plan that offers some basic services, catastrophic services, and let the private market kind of add on the additional private insurance that someone would need to go for with that? In order to control cost, in order to contain costs on Medicare, why is that not part of the plan versus this voucher program?
Well, I'd say a couple things. First of all, it's not a voucher program. And if you look at the origins of this plan, it goes back to the Clinton Medicare Commission. 1998 was appointed, and 1999 they put the report out. That was led by Senator Breaux of Louisiana and Congressman Thomas. And they talked about a premium support plan, which is what this plan is. This plan is based on what they were talking about in that Medicare Commission. And I got a quote yesterday, actually, from Senator Breaux from 99, where he says, this is not a voucher plan. A lot of people are going to call it that because politically that's what they want to say. But a voucher plan would be where you get a voucher and you, separate from the government, go out and just shop on the open market. That's not what this is. This replicates what members of Congress and federal employees have, in that the federal government is still in charge, and they pick and choose who can compete within this framework for your business. And I have never heard a member of Congress say, I have a voucher plan. I've never heard a member of Congress say they don't like their plan. And this is the sort of plan that Senator Breaux and Senator Kerry of Nebraska backed then, and it's what we're adopting now. To your broader question of allowing for sort of a supplement to the government, well, that's to some extent what we have with Medicare Advantage and some of the other plans. This keeps all of it under the federal government, and that is why it is not privatized. It is managed by, the guidelines are chosen by, established by the federal government. Ultimately, this is about doing a couple things. First of all, it's about saving Medicare. Now, a lot of people are saying, this gets rid of Medicare as we know it. Well, Medicare as we know it is bankrupt in 8 to 9 years. If someone really wanted to get rid of Medicare, they wouldn't propose a bold reform. They would do nothing. If you do nothing, the status quo will kill Medicare. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, we all acknowledge, well, most of us acknowledge, that Medicare is on its way to bankruptcy. What this does ultimately is it is a path to change Medicare for people under 55, yes, but it's a path to save Medicare. If you wanted to do something bad to Medicare, you would simply do nothing and it would take care of itself.
Let's talk about another aspect of the Ryan plan, and that is that it does actually cut some of the spending for the military, about $78 billion over the course of the 10 years, which unfortunately is kind of chump change in the grand scheme of what we're talking about with trillions of dollars. We have a large spread out military operation all over the world, two wars at work. Is there more savings to be had from efficiencies and paring back our military spending than the $78 billion that's even in here? Should we be looking at that in that direction?
We need to be looking everywhere. I'm not ruling anything out. And a lot of the efficiencies that you're talking about are ones that were recommended by Secretary of Defense Bill Gates. Secretary of Defense Gates. And what's interesting about that is Secretary Gates and the Budget Committee, they looked at this, and we talk about cuts, but there is a difference between, often there's a difference between a Washington cut and a cut to you and me. And what I mean by that is, to us, if you receive more money next year than you receive this year, That's not a cut. Well, in Washington, if you slow the growth, even though you're going up, that's a cut. So to be fair, when you talk about cuts in the context of this budget, a lot of them are savings. They wouldn't be really cuts to you and me. For example, there's not one penny of cuts on in Medicare or Medicaid in this budget. They are continuing to grow. They're continuing to increase, just not as fast. Now, with the defense budget, it's the same type deal. The defense budget has continued to grow. And people talk about defense cuts because it's not as much as this person wanted or that person wanted. But ultimately, that budget, in real terms, has grown every year. We've got to look everywhere we can to identify places to save in the defense budget. And you may have seen that I fought the alternate engine program for the F-35. F-35 fighter has a good engine. The government was funding competition for their own engine. And that engine program we voted down, and there was some talk about getting it going again. Well, it was canceled this week. There's a lot more, in my view, that can be saved. We shouldn't do it willy-nilly and just go in and start slashing because we have troops that count on it. But we should conduct vigorous oversight, and we should hold the Department of Defense accountable, and we should look for places where we can save. Let me tell you something that a lot of people don't know. The Department of Defense is required to produce auditable financial statements. They haven't done it, ever. They can't do it. They are unable. So I am working on some legislation that would set some benchmarks and require them to check in with Congress and tell us how they're doing to get to that point. Every taxpayer dollar is precious, whether it's at DOD or somewhere else, and we've got to make sure it's being spent wisely.
You have a big vote coming up sometime in the near future, particularly when you go back in session, on the debt ceiling.
That's
either
right.
Raising the debt ceiling or not raising the debt ceiling. What is going to trigger your vote? If something happens, you vote for it, or are you adamantly opposed to raising the debt ceiling no matter what?
I'm a no right now. I understand what a big deal it is. I have studied it extensively. I've read the policy commentary on it. I've read the political commentary on it. I've heard what Secretary Geithner and the President and the President's spokesperson have said about it. I've also listened to a lot of Arkansans about it. I am a no right now. And I've been thinking through, as we start to approach that date of when we're going to hit the limit, I've been thinking through of what's it going to take for me to vote yes. Because I understand that we have to pay our bills and we have to live within our means. I understand also that we have a debt crisis separate from the ceiling. Just the fact that we've got so much debt is a crisis on the horizon as well. So what I want to do is I want to get some structural, substantive changes agreed to by the President and the Senate so that we can know that we're going to take that spending curve that's skyrocketing upward and start bending it down so that we can see some end to this mess. And whether that comes in the form of spending caps, whether it comes in the form of balanced budget amendment plus spending caps, I haven't decided specifically yet. And the reason is I don't want to agree to something that's easily undone. Whatever I agree to needs to have teeth so that we know that the President is not going to just ignore it, or the Congress is not going to just ignore it a year or two down the road. So I am working through that process now, but I can tell you I see this as an opportunity to get the attention of the President. And the reason I say that, he put a budget, his first budget, before he took a mulligan on his budget, he had his first budget, it did nothing to deal with the drivers of the debt. Nothing. Nothing. And so I want to see that he gets it. He took a mulligan after the House budget came out, and he tried again. I still don't think he gets the urgency that I feel. And I tell people, I think it's a good point to make, I tell people every day when I talk about the debt, I'm not, you know, a one-note guy, but this, our house is on fire. And if I think it's a 10 crisis on a scale of 1 to 10, and my constituents think it's a 3, then they're not going to understand why I'm so focused on it. And so that's why I talk about it, to tell people. And I believe it is a jobs issue. Don't let anyone tell you that jobs is separate from the debt. If we don't deal with the debt, we're going to have massive job losses. If we want to be the innovative job-creating engine that America has historically been, we better deal with the debt or we're never going to be there. We're going to have a lower standard of living for my kids versus what we grew up with.
Tim Griffin represents Arkansas's 2nd District in the U.S. House and talked with Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net, this week.
And support for content from TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. And Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon communication store or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness.